Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
Welcome to News Talk A3OWCCO and a special presentation tonight. We are live. We are live in the Cambria Gallery in downtown Minneapolis as we celebrate Black History Month with a roundtable discussion. My name is Henry Lake, one of your hosts tonight with Shaletta Brundage as well. Give it up for Shaletta. And I'm so excited to have the audience that we have here tonight, and I thank you for coming, and the guest panel that we have assembled for tonight's conversation. Black History Month is just a highlight of what living as an African-American in this country is every day. The words strength, patience, and perseverance all come to mind when I think of the journey of Black people in this country. So before I do anything else, I would like to introduce our panelists for the roundtable tonight. Benjamin Mackay. He's an educational consultant, historian, and founder of the African American Registry and creator of his Teachers Forum subscription service. His curriculum reform model is working with four Minnesota University Schools of Education teaching programs. In 2017, Mr. Mackay was Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton's Martin Luther King Day Lifetime Achievement Award winner. And in 2018, he joined the Roy Wilkins Fellowship to speak to the Fifth World Conference on Remedies to Racial and Ethnic Economic Inequality. Benjamin Mackay. Our next panelist, Deborah Montgomery. And this woman is truly amazing. And when I saw the video about her and having a name, a street named after her, I said, that's one role model right there that I want to live up to. She's the first female police officer in the city of St. Paul and former St. Paul City Council member, Deborah Montgomery. This gentleman has quite the personality, I can tell already, and we just met tonight. But Obie Kipper Jr., whose family was the first Black family in far south Minneapolis, and I'm really inquisitive as to his life's experiences. Now, Mr. Kipper attended Minnesota State University, Mankato, earning his BS and MS degrees. His master's degree was in vocational counseling and special education. He's been involved in education, athletics, and community activities for an extended number of years. A recipient of the MSU Alumni of the Year Award and a former athlete who was inducted into the Minnesota State University Mankato Athletic Hall of Fame in 1990 for track and field, and again in 2008 for the MSU track and field team, which was ranked sixth in the nation. Currently, he is the CEO of Vocational Rehabilitation and Employment Consultants Incorporated. Obie Kipper Jr. And last but not least, I look at a dear friend of mine to my immediate left, Frank White. He's an author, historian. His exhibit in the back that you guys can check out over the course of the next hour, For the Love of the Game, which is on display here tonight. And he's such a positive contributor, not only to the sports community, but to our community in general. That will be Frank White. I want to thank all of you for being here tonight. And February is known as African-American, you know, Black History Month. But I'd be remiss to start our conversation tonight without acknowledging the efforts of Carter G. Woodson. He was an African-American historian and scholar who dedicated his life to Black history. And he understood the significance and importance of preserving our story with pioneering Black History Week. And I'm thankful to him for that. So I wanted to start, Mr. McKay, with you. In your opinion, when we look at Black History Month, what is the biggest positive impact that it's had on our community? And I ask that because I read somewhere that Mr. Woodson wanted to instill that self-esteem in Black people years ago.
Well, what you read is true about Dr. Woodson. The first question, I would answer that it's important for African Americans to preserve our stories, because if we don't do it, it will never be done properly or at all. And I think Dr. Woodson knew that very deeply. To try and answer the relevance of his position with Black History Month, I'm going to quote something that he said in 1926 when he was asked about the relevance of then National Negro Week. And he said that if a race has no history, it has no worthwhile tradition. It becomes negligible as a factor in the thought of the world at large. He also went on to say that it stands in danger of being exterminated if it is not recorded. And he quoted two other non-white groups, if you will, to cement his example. He said the American Indian left no conscious record. He did not appreciate the value of his tradition. And where is the American Indian today? Again, this was said in 1926. And then he went on to say the Hebrew keenly appreciated the value of tradition, as it is attested in the Bible itself. In spite of worldwide persecution, therefore, he is a great factor in our civilization in 1926. So that's how I'd answer the question.
I got you. It's kind of interesting when we talk about the word history, okay? And the reason why I bring that up is because years ago when I was working in Minneapolis public school system, with young people, when you talk to them about history, they tend to go thinking, well, back in my day, that the old, you know, the old way of, you know, the old people, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. and stuff like that many, many years ago. And they don't necessarily think about the history that we're making right now. So, Mr. Kipper, when you think about, you know, young people and them having the connection with today and the things that are going on today, how do you think that we make a better connection with them in regards to that?
That's a good question. I'm of the opinion that we have to lead by example. I think that if we do the things correctly and we go to school, we get the education, we stay off the drugs and alcohol, I think that we can impact the children. It's very critical that for us that have had opportunities to succeed, that we pass those lessons along. To not do that, we have failed. And I'm of the opinion that education is one way to get that done. We've got to keep our youth in school, and we've got to get them going toward voc-tech colleges, community colleges, and liberal arts schools so they can be economically independent and move forward.
No question. All right, we got to take our first break. We got some bills that we have to pay, but stay with us. The Black History Month Roundtable continues on News Talk 830 WCCO. CCO, Henry Lake, Shaletta Brundage, Ben McKay, Deborah Montgomery, Obi Kipper Jr., and Frank White. Shaletta.
I am so honored to be sharing the stage with Ms. Deborah Montgomery. You cannot tell the history of St. Paul without mentioning her name, the first female, not just African-American female, Henry, the first female police officer in St. Paul, hired in 1975. We don't even know half of what you had to go through to blaze that trail for women to come behind. I want you to talk to me about not just the obstacles you faced, but African-American females in policing. There's so few, if any, on the force in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Talk to those women who are listening tonight about how they can join the force and be a part of the solution and not the problem.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, it's a great profession. TV shows all the negative things, but they don't show the positive things that we do. As you know, the model is to protect and serve, and that was one of the things that I made my commitment to when I took my oath of office. Back in 1971, Miles Lord, there was an NAACP lawsuit against the St. Paul Police Department. They had four African Americans on the job and about 600 police officers. 6% of the population was African American. And so they had the lawsuit, and the union was fighting getting any on. And in 1974, it became a life safety issue. And so they went ahead and posted for an exam. And 2,000 people actually signed up for 50 jobs, and 450 were women. And you had to take a civil service test, a psychological, a physical, and then you had to run an obstacle course. And that was the kicker, because it was a West Point military physical agility test. And so you had a women didn't get into West Point until 1976, so that tells you about that test. You had to run 25 yards, get over a 4-foot fence, 25 yards, get over a 6-foot wall, 25 yards, climb a ladder, jump down into a cylinder. They had a hole cut for a 6-foot tall person. So I was 5'6 3/4". And you had to jump out, and then you had to run this obstacle course, and it was timed. There were 450 women, and I was the only woman to pass, and only 8 men had done better than I did. I was a jock in my younger days. So that was the test. And at that time, I was a city planner and assistant to the mayor of the city of St. Paul, Larry Cohen, at the time. And I had wrote a letter. It's in my file. It says, thank you for the opportunity to take the test, but no thanks. I don't want the job. Because it was a $10,000 cut in pay. You only needed a GED to be a police officer, and I had a master's degree, so it was a little different. And then on the Friday before the academy was supposed to start, one of the African-American men dropped out. So the mayor called me and said, I need you to do me a favor. Will you go sit in the academy for 2 weeks? I said, excuse me, this is a cut in pay. Don't worry, you're going to be taken care of. Yeah. Never trust a politician. So anyway, that Saturday, they're rushing me down to Uniforms Unlimited and trying to get me fitted into a man's uniform. Oh, wow. And the height, most of the guys were 6 feet tall, and so here I am, 5'6", and they're cutting off the sleeve to shirts. They're cutting off the tail. We have a little posterior, so they're adding pieces to the pants. And the tie was hanging down further than anything else. And, it was men's shoes. I had to wear men's shoes, and I had this hat. I looked like Clarabelle the Clown is what I felt. And so anyway, that they got me fitted that Saturday, and then the seamstresses were working real hard. And we were in the academy on that Monday. And we had 10 of us that were 10 African-Americans in that class. And out of 50. And so we're in the class, and we had law exams, quizzes every day. And so I would be tutoring the other 9 African-American men so that we would make sure that we all passed.
And you have always done that. You have always given advice and been here for the community. What's the one piece of advice you would give African-American women who hear your story?
You know what? Thank you so much. It's a great profession, and you can have a great impact on the people that you touch. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I enjoyed the most. Even with the criminals, get to understand where their issues mm-hmm. are. And then try, I always tell my students when I'm teaching, bring your toolbox with you. You know, bring your resources. You know, when somebody, has got a domestic or something like that, make some referrals, right on the street, Back in the day, we didn't have to arrest. We could separate and tell somebody wanted to go another way. Mm-hmm. Now today, you have to arrest. But, it was easy for me to sit down because I was very good at using community resources. Mm-hmm. And if I identified a problem, I would go ahead and try to get those things.
Yeah. Wow.
I want to bring Frank White into the conversation. Frank White is somebody that, as a kid, I would, you know, always be at the North High games and all the high school basketball games. I would see him refereeing and stuff like that. And I didn't really know him at that time. But then later on, we went on a trip together. It was me, Frank, and our friend who's here tonight, Joe Gallagher. And we went to go see his grandson, Royce, while he was playing at Iowa State. And we really bonded and connected from that time moving forward. Your exhibit in the back, you know, they play for the love of the game. And you wrote a book. Where did that labor of love in regards to the history and doing the research and all of that kind of create it? Where did that come from for you?
I think that for me, like, it's we haven't done a good job of documenting our history. In some cases, we have, but when I think back as a kid and remember watching a lot of guys that played with my father or against my father, some of the recent books that had been done never mentioned those individuals. And so for me, it somewhere along the way, I decided that I was going to write about those individuals. They deserved that. They were outstanding baseball players. And a little bit, you know, my dad is included in that. I try not to always talk about my dad, although my father was a great athlete, great baseball player. But I just think it was so important to document that history and share about some of the outstanding players. You can't really talk about Minnesota Black baseball without talking about the St. Paul Colored Gophers or the St. Paul Gophers. And there's other individuals. There's John Donaldson, tremendous pitcher. Pete Gordon is here this evening and trying to still get him into the Hall of Fame. But there's guys like Kenny Christian, Cecil Littles, some of the people on the Minneapolis side, Leroy Hardiman, Larry Bubba Brown, that people just don't know were great athletes. And so my attempt was, again, to honor those individuals and through baseball and everyday life because of the challenges that were presented. And I thought that was important. So the book is not just about baseball, but it's also about everyday life in the Twin Cities and the things that people had to go through. And one of the quotes that I always like to share is that in 1942, one of the city council members in the city of St. Paul, in his reelection bid, made a quote that goes something like this: "The Negro needs to know his place, and his place is not with white people, and for sure not in your place of business." So when we think about being here in the North, so to speak, it also ends up being a situation that we had challenges, we had struggles, we had to persevere. And for me, I didn't realize that until much later in life, even though I knew there was bias. But I think I haven't really fully realized that until I got older and have done some of the research and looked at some of those stories.
Yeah. So. No, that's important work that you and specifically Mr. Mackay that you guys are doing. We got to take another brief pause, but we'll come back more with the Black History Roundtable on News Talk 830 WCCO. All right, welcome back. News Talk 830 WCCO. Our Black History Month Roundtable conversation. Shaletta Brundage. We also have Ben Mackay, Deborah Montgomery, Obi Kipper Jr., and Frank White. And I'm one of your hosts, Henry Lake. I want to go to Mr. Mackay right now to start this segment because one of the things that I want to know from you and your perspective is who is someone locally, still alive, still living, that we should appreciate, that we should maybe honor right now, because there are so many people that do a lot of hard work and have done so in years past and still continue to do. But a lot of times in life, we don't honor those people in the present moment. And the reason why I bring that up is because, unfortunately, everybody knows one of the biggest stories of the year was the tragic passing of Kobe Bryant. And I've seen a theme of a lot of athletes being honored by their universities, the teams that they played for, because tomorrow is not promised to each and every one of us. And I'll never forget something that occurred years ago in which I had got off from work one day from one of the schools, Nellie Stone Johnson, and I went home and I took a nap, and I figured, you know, I'll go and I'll work out and all that stuff, whatever. But before I went home and took a nap, I stopped by Cub Foods, and I bumped into Charles Hallman from the Spokesman Recorder. And that was at a time in which a gentleman that I love to this day, Kwame McDonald, was battling cancer. And Charles saw me and said, you know, things are not good, and we're kind of at the end of the road. And I said, okay, I'm glad that you told me that. And I said, I need to get by there. And so I went home, and I laid down. And you know how sleep will get to you, right? And it gets good, and you start saying, well, you know, you start, you know, maybe I'll get by there tomorrow. And you start, I came up with all these excuses as to why I'm tired. But then I started thinking, I'm like, I'm talking about I'm tired, and I have my health, and Kwame, who's a dear friend, I don't know if I'm ever going to get an opportunity to see him again. And so I got up out that bed, and I made my way over to St. Paul, and I visited him in his hospice care, and I walked in the room, and I grabbed the newspaper and had the TV on, some college basketball, and I'm watching the game, and I'm reading the newspaper to him. And he couldn't communicate clearly to me or whatever, but before I walked in the room, the lady told me he can understand and he hears everything that you're saying to him. And so I was there for about 90 minutes, and then there was another couple that's his next-door neighbors. They came in to spend their time. And I left. I went home. And the next morning, he had passed away. And I'll never forget that, because I said to myself, if I never had got out of bed and went and visited Kwame, I never would have seen him that last time. And so I will always cherish that moment. So when we know that tomorrow is not promised to each and every one of us, who is maybe the person for you that you would say you would like to honor them and they should smell the roses while they're still alive? Because I remember towards the end when Kwame was ill, he was honored at St. Paul Central, and I appreciated that.
I think the person that pops out this evening, and thank you for asking the question, because the work of the registry had a chance to interview Kwame a couple of years before he passed, and he certainly was filled with a lot of wisdom that he brought up from Cleveland straight and in St. Paul. But to directly answer your question, I would say Mahmoud Al-Khatib is the person that I think... it's not that he needs more props, for lack of a better term. It is just that he's a walking history book, literally. He just knows, and he comes from a small community in Georgia, went through Wilberforce University before he came to McAllister. He mentors young people every day. He's a dynamic speaker, and he just gets it from a Pan-African perspective and an African in the Americas perspective. And he's been around long enough to have, you know, I mean, he represented the University of Minnesota when they were looking for a Latino studies department, because he had already been on the ground putting together the African and African-American studies department, but there were no Latino people for the university to connect with, and he helped get that started. So his track record is spotless, and I think more people should know about the good work that he's been responsible for.
Yes. I remember the Saturdays being in his Akefren studies, Saturday mornings, many years ago, back when I was eighth grader, ninth grader, and me and my friends from Brett College Prep would go there on Saturdays and learn from Kwame. So,
amen.
I mean, not from Kwame, but from Mahmoud Al-Khatib. So, let me come to Mr. Kipper Jr. Your family was one of the, well, not one of the, but the first black family in the far south side of Minneapolis many years ago, back when they were redlining for black families. Your brother Stanley once told a story to the Minneapolis Star Tribune about how about, you know, you guys, in terms of your family, how you got your house back then. Can you kind of relay that story? Because he put it into a play, I think, right?
That's correct. My brother Stanley Kipper put together a play, and it was successful. And he did it from his perspective, and we talked a lot about what should be in it. He's 2 years younger than me. So his perspective was a little different because he was younger.
Yeah.
But my family migrated here from Missouri, Paris, Missouri. My mother was an educator. My dad was a master sergeant in the Army, and he had an all-black unit. The military was very segregated then. Long story short, in Paris, Missouri, town of 500-600 when I was a little one, there was nowhere to go. My family, the uncles, they decided to come to Minnesota. Well, one of the uncles bought a house on 3852 Fifth Avenue. How he did it, I do not know, but it was a big house. So here comes my family. We're behind them, so there's 10 of us in this house. So all of a sudden, and it was fun, and my dad started with a job pushing a broom and gambles in the downstairs. See, because in those days, Black Fork weren't allowed on the first floor, especially during the daytime hours. So they kept him in the basement. Man, my old man, he was no nonsense. He wasn't going to last long. And he didn't. So he ended up at the Postal Service. And my mom was finishing work at the University of Minnesota, working on her third degree. And what happened was is we moved from my uncle's house at 3852 Clinton. They got a couple nickels. We moved over to 3824 Clinton. Now, I thought we were going backward. Our room was so small, we had to have bunk beds to fit in that room. But it was our house. And so as my dad received and earned promotions and my mom became a teacher, she was one of a handful of African-American teachers that was hired by the Minneapolis District in 1956. The nickels came in. They saved a little money. So the old man, he was a leader, boy. He said, think we're going to move. I thought, oh, okay. I didn't pay any attention to it. So he says they saved some nickels, and at the post office he made a couple friends. They were white, and he said, well, we're going to buy this house. I didn't know anything about it. So anyway, he gets together with his friends, and this is a true story, and he says, I want to get that house on 4505 Oakland. But in the covenant back in the day, if black folk couldn't go past 42nd Street, you couldn't do it. And in the covenant of the properties, it stated that the whites would not sell their house to anything black or Indian. And so my dad's thinking, okay, how am I going to figure this out? And I'm learning this later. I didn't know it at the time. So he goes to his friends. He gets together some pennies and puts it together. And his white friend goes and buys the house. Now, the irony of that is he's going in posing as my dad. So he goes in, and he's Obie Kipper. Now, I'm Obie Kipper Jr. Now, you know, he's white. You can tell what I am. And so anyway, he goes in, and he's working with the sales rep and da-da-da-da-da. Long story short, the guy that my dad's friend, he had to come back with the papers to get my dad to sign them. And the real estate guy couldn't figure out why he wouldn't sign them there. And his friend said, well, I got to think about this. I got to talk to my wife. So he goes, my mom, dad sign the papers, and eventually they get the house. But here's the irony. They go to settle on the house. They hand the my dad's friend, who was white, the keys from the white realtor and the people that own the house. And the guy says, Obie, come get your house. And the realtor about had a heart attack. I mean, a stone-cold heart attack. Now, I knew nothing about all this. I'm at camp with Benji. I grew up with Benji. Benji and I are at a camp. I come back. We all live within one or two blocks of one another in South Minneapolis, the village. Now they call it a ghetto, but it was a village. And my dad says, well, I think we're going back to 3824 Clinton. I'm saying, I'm going home. Well, I got to take you somewhere else, son. Where are you taking me? We're going, got in a different house. So here we go. We go out to 4505 Oakland. We're past 42nd Street. And I'm looking around. I don't see nothing that looks like me. I see my brother, I see my mom and dad go in the house. And that's when it got interesting. We moved in that house. Next thing we know, telephone wires, which ran outside in those days, getting cut. gas lines going into this house, our house being damaged, windows being broke, feces placed at the front door. Now, my old man was no nonsense, and my uncles hunted, so the old man always had, you know, hunting guns. And I remember pulling one out. He sat it behind the chair. I says, what's that for? He says, the next one's going to get some buckshot and that you know what. And so anyway, the other part of that was when we moved out there, in the next 120 days, half the block was up for sale. They call it white flight. I mean, the houses went up faster than you pop popcorn. And then the kids, I had not been around these kids. So they experienced, I experienced what discrimination and racism was about.
Yeah.
And that, we ended up in that house, and it put us in the Washburn School District. Now, our mothers taught in the Minneapolis School Districts as elementary ed, three of us. Viola Johnson, Mary Frances Kipper, my mother, Mrs. Hyde, all teachers.
Yeah.
And but they didn't want us to go to Washburn.
Let me I'm going to let you complete that thought here. We got to take one brief pause. We'll come back. We got another final long segment here on the Black History Month Roundtable here on News Talk 830 WCCO. All right, final segment here, News Talk 830 WCCO, Black History Month Roundtable. And I don't want to waste any time. Let's hop back into – I want to let Mr. Kipper finish up his conversation in regards to going back to his family in South Minneapolis and being the first black family over in far South Minneapolis. Back in what year was this?
1957. Our family moved in. At that time when we moved in, it was very different. It was hard. But we made progress. And we're talking in part about baseball. As black families moved in, we integrated the baseball teams, and we won the city. It was an integrated team. It was through athletics that helped us bridge some of that gap, even at Washburn, which was a very difficult experience for me. The kids were great, but their parents, they had issues as far as diversity. Not all, but some. So long story short, that's how we began our ventures into South Minneapolis in the white community.
Yeah. I saw something recently. Explore Minnesota had an article that I saw, and the topic was five TV shows that made Minnesota famous. They were The Mary Tyler Moore Show, Little House on the Prairie, Coach, The Rocky and Bullwinkle Show, and Fargo. Now, I'm not going to dispute that those shows didn't make Minnesota famous or not, but there was one show that it wasn't a lengthy show. It was just a couple of episodes, but I remember it because I want to say I was about finishing up my sophomore year of college at Morehouse, and it was on HBO, and it was called Laurel Avenue. And to me, representation matters, especially when we, you know, say that diversity matters, right? And so I always think about that show. But I also acknowledge and know that for a lot of people, talking about race and racism is hard for them. Frank, why do you feel like it's such a hard thing for people to address and to talk about? And before you give me your answer, I do want to acknowledge and say thank you to Royce White, who is here tonight, because right now in sports, one of the topics that people are talking about is mental health. And Royce doesn't get the props that he deserves. He's one of our own. And he created that conversation because Kevin Love and DeMar DeRozan from an NBA perspective are getting love with it. Tyson Fury, who I appreciate, and we talked about him on the show last night, the boxer that just won last week, and he's getting a lot of props. But Royce, thank you for all of that. We appreciate it. But how would you why do you think it's such a hard thing to talk about when we talk about race in America?
I'm
not trying to get too deep on it.
I think that for me, I think it's difficult because people maybe don't want to completely share where they are in life. And people don't want to tell you I'm biased. We all have bias, right? Every one of us has bias. And I think when we begin to talk about race, it exposes us. It exposes who we are. And I think people literally are afraid to share that on an everyday basis, and because it's going to open up some thoughts that people may have about you. And I, And I think that gets very personal for people. Unless you're one of the extremes. You know, if you're a racist, people probably know you're racist. So I think it's difficult for that, because I think it's a very personal situation, and everybody doesn't want to share that inner part of themselves. So,
Mr. Mackay, when we talk about Black History Month, a lot of times for young people, they hear the names Martin Luther King Jr., Rosa Parks, Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, but we don't localize it enough. We don't talk about the Nellie Stone Johnsons, the Sharon Sales Beltons, the Lou Bellamys. Do you think that we have to do a better job in our specific communities in terms of talking about the people that that we should know a lot more about?
Yes, we do. I think that's true in every community, whether you're in Los Angeles or Houston or Minneapolis, St. Paul. I think that the marketing, if I could use that term, of African-American heritage, which is a result of culture and history combined, is something that should be affirmed rather than celebrated. You don't lose any luster if you affirm something instead of celebrating it. And I think it should be done every day. And I think that there are stories, matter of fact, I know through the work of the registry that there are plenty of stories outside of folks on this stage that are there to be told, and they're there to be cherished, and it's something that our children want. They may not articulate it as well as they should, but it's really the job of the elders and those of us in between to make sure that those stories get conveyed.
Ms. Montgomery, outside of your parents, who were the people that most significantly, positively impacted your life early on?
Well, Bill Peterson, for one. We lived at Oxford Recreation Center. I mean, that was the place to be at, and it was a pit. I mean, you know, they now had said that it was contaminated, but we played and ate enough dirt over there that... But, you know, he kept us engaged with not a lot of things. We just had a little warming house. There had been 6 Quonset huts on the playground, and they had a merry-go-round and 6 swings. But he found a way to put up hockey rinks and teach us, get us skates so we could skate. So I think that was one. I always talk about Father Denzel Carty. He was the priest at St. Philip's Church, and he was the one that got me engaged in the civil rights movement. He was always telling us about, you know, the different things going on and how we should be engaged in it. And so, I think those are a couple. Judge Stephen Maxwell, Dr. England, Ben Alexander, George Brooks. I mean, all of those families tied to the St. Paul community and were very supportive in all of us young people that were there. So I think those are just some of the people. I always think about Freddie Slimmons, the golf guy. I mean, he was into golf, lived down the street from us. So it was a pretty good. Ben Alexander, George Brooks, the funeral home, But, I mean, all the thing that was nice, and somebody mentioned it earlier, we had a village. Mm-hmm. And that's what we don't have today. We have neighborhoods today. But we had a village, and everybody took care of everybody. They made sure that if somebody needed something and they had it, they would share. And the kids were, you know, everybody knew the kids. They weren't afraid to talk to young people. They knew you by your name. If you acted up, they're going to stop and, you know, tell you this isn't acceptable behavior. So it was those kinds of things that I thought were part of the village and appreciated.
I want to thank each and every one of you. Real quick.
One quick thing. Debbie is great leader, great mind, great heart, activist, and most of us think of that. But this lady was probably one of our greatest athletes in St. Paul. And it's undocumented because ladies weren't allowed to play at that point in time. But wow. This lady was an outstanding athlete, and she would be picked sometimes before the boys would be. So, yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I want to personally thank each and every one of you for being a part of this, and I want to thank everybody that came out tonight, because I understand, as a black man in the media, which typically doesn't get the type of platform that I have here in Minnesota, I know the importance of it, and I appreciate you guys supporting everything that I do. I appreciate everything that you guys have done and continue to do for our community.
Let me stop you. I need to thank you for putting this together, for getting these people on this stage, for getting you all here, for telling the bosses that not only did we have to do it, but we had to do it right. This is all Henry Lake's vision, and it's coming to pass tonight.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
So let's give him a round of applause for the work and effort that he put into making sure our history continues to be told.
Shaletta, I appreciate you so much. We're out of time. Now we can eat.
Amen.
We appreciate you listening to the Black History Roundtable here on News Talk 830 WCCO.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.